have various talents and abilities, and it's good to rejoice in that and enjoy what you're doing. Obviously, Richard and Lorraine do that, and it's a good thing. I have been granted to be able to look at a piece of wood sometimes and see something in there and take a hammer and chisel and let it out. And I rejoice in that. I enjoy it greatly. When I'm doing that and making chips fly over the place, the time just flies away. Pretty soon, my wife's at the stairs at the shop calling, "Aren't you going to come for supper?" And I don't know where the time went to, but whatever it happens to be, rejoice in what God has given you and do it with all your might. I'm going to read the passage again, Titus 3:1-3. Remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration for all men. For we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. So here we have people living, of course, in the Roman Empire. And Paul here is turning now from within to without. So he has laid out for the church various roles. This is what I want you to do with the elders. These are the qualifications, what I want them to do. This is what I want the young men to do, the young women, the older men, the older women. And so he's talking within. And he's told them to stand up and essentially do what is right, no matter their age or their gender or their station. And by their actions, they're going to stand out from the society in Crete. It's still true today. And Paul is talking about conduct within the church. Now he turns to society and he's speaking of how the church should interact with society at large. Verses 1 and 2 are a single sentence in the Greek. And so Paul is treating with responsibilities relating to the citizenship in the empire, and then to people in general. And so we've seen instructions in other letters like Romans 13:1-7 from Paul, and there the central idea is render whatever is due to the various authorities. Also we have 1 Peter 2:13-17, where Peter says we are free, but not to use our freedom as an excuse for any wicked act. And so people of faith sometimes struggle with the concept of submission to a government of wicked and ungodly men. Quite honestly, I don't think I've seen people of faith ever struggle quite so much as they did in the last presidential election, as they kind of hesitated between a rock and a hard place, so to speak. So what is a Christian citizen, and what exactly should a Christian citizen be? How do we render to Caesar the things of Caesar and render to God the things of God? Now, Paul was not simply saying go along to get along, because if we look at the history of Paul and if we look at the history of the church, all of these events are far too complex to say that. We're citizens here on earth, but we're also citizens of heaven. And when standing before Pilate, Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." If my kingdom were of this world, my disciples would be fighting for me, so I would not be delivered over. And so the question for Christians, how do we balance the two citizenships? If we take a look in the Old Testament back to the history of Israel, they were exiled out of the Holy Land. And Jeremiah 29:7 says, "And seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare." We are inextricably bound in our welfare to the welfare of the state and the country and the city where we are. And so these things affect us. So Christians should be praying for both the federal government, the state, and the local, because in its welfare, we will have welfare. At that time, there was a custom called benefaction. Wealthy citizens would give something to the state, and then the state would be praising them. And so in 1 Timothy, Paul enjoins the church, pray for the rulers, pray for those in authority. And so the church, through prayer and through the exemplary behavior of the congregation, is seen as a benefactor to the state. These are the kind of people we want. Christians in any society should be light and salt. Light to show others the way in a dark place, and salt to preserve society from decay. The quote from Jeremiah carries the idea. Actually, the theory remains in Israel to this day. The ultra-Orthodox there are exempted from military service, and they say that by their prayers they've done more to sustain Israel than all the armies and all the reserves there in Israel. So in verse 1, Paul tells Titus to continue reminding the congregation of submission to authority. And so this implies that it's already been taught, but they need to be reminded, possibly due to the influence of some of the false teachers that he is talking about. Rulerships and authorities are to be obeyed. Now, we see subject to rulers and obedient. So, subjection is one thing and obedience is another. Each and every citizen is subject to the rules. All of us are subject to the laws that set speed limits, and we might get a ticket for speeding. But not all of us are in obedience to the laws. We are automatically subject, but we are not automatically obedient. So rulers and authorities seem to indicate it doesn't matter whether it's local or empire-wide. The congregation was to be in subjection. Rebellion was not something Paul wanted the church to be associated with. Rebellion or the threat of rebellion is something that inspires great fear in the government and society, and that continues to this day. And the church is not in the business of changing society by rebellion. Are we in the business of changing society? Oh, yes. We certainly are. But we're in the business of changing individual lives by the application of the gospel, one person at a time. And these lives are added to the church, and the changed person functions within the body of the church. To be ready for every good work shows the exemplary behavior of the Christian. It's a person who's both needed and wanted in society. Someone that'll stop what they're doing, someone that will step aside to do something good for no other reason than they want to do something good. They don't make trouble for the government, and they are ever ready to do something good for those they come in contact with on a daily basis. Verse 2 goes on with general instructions: blaspheme or malign no one. And this can mean insult, slander, speak against. It would include cursing somebody else. Malign no one. Perhaps no phrase in the entire book of Titus is more needed or appropriate today. Where is the courtesy that we used to see years ago in conversation? Where is the restraint on bad words in mixed company? We certainly have not increased our courtesy in speech. So we think of loud, angry, bitter words, non-fighting, that's clear enough. We're not to be quarrelsome. Now, it's inevitable that disagreements will come. They always come. I made my living through conflict resolution for many years. I've heard many angry and bitter words. We don't necessarily have to be disagreeable about it. If you listen to an attorney or somebody that makes their living in an adversarial sort of a way, most of them are highly professional, and they're not saying cutting or bitter things. They're just presenting their side of the argument in as professional a way as they can. If Paul was writing today, I think he would probably enjoin Christians from writing bitter or insulting things on Facebook or Twitter. So we could see, you know, the gospel according to 2017. Don't use the mask of anonymity of the internet to write nasty things. That's not who we are. Because we have unending political and religious debate today in that media. But the writings in Timothy or Titus warn against disputes and endless speculations. Could be on the law, could be on commandments written by men. But the point is, the nature of these disagreements is that they're so speculative, they're so out there, there's no way to come to resolution. It just can't be done. And so, essentially boils down to arguing for the sake of argument. It's pointless. If someone is thoroughly indoctrinated in a certain point of view, and they're not going to budge, and they're not going to listen, the best advice I can give you is don't waste your time and breath. You're not going to happen. It serves no good purpose. So by contrast, Christians are to be gentle or reasonable and courteous. It stands out from the rough and ready culture there, and certainly from our culture today, which seems to be less and less courteous or conciliatory. So now, if you say something I don't agree with, then evidently I have the right to come and whack you over the head with a club to make you stop saying it. That's a long way from this passage. Displaying all meekness toward all men. Christians are to be easy to get along with. Here again, this will stand out. It could be translated as showing every consideration to all men. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to change doctrine. That doesn't mean that we have to go along with the crowd when they're doing something that offends our conscience. But there are very considerate and gentle ways of saying no. You could say, no thanks. I don't care for that. Believe me, it doesn't take rough words for somebody else to get the message of what you're all about. It doesn't take much at all. You'd be surprised how fast they pick it up. Now, if we take a very literal translation of the next part, it says, "For even we ourselves were formerly senseless, disobedient, deceived, slaving for desires and pleasures of various kinds, living in malice and envy, detestable, hating one another." So Paul is making a comparison here, pre-salvation, post-salvation. And he lists seven characteristics of the pre-salvation state. And the message to Christians is, look where you were at one time. Before you revile the unsaved, before you consider yourself, oh, I'm so much better than they are, remember where you came from. Remember the grace you were shown. Grace was totally a gift. You didn't work for it. And so you should be grateful for the gift that was given to you. And make very sure that these various vices don't creep back into your life after salvation. So the seven sins can be divided into three classes: ignorance, slavery, and relationship issues. The first three vices are fruits of ignorance, then slavery of sin, and finally, the sins which are so destructive of any good relationship. And if this list is looked at with care, the flaws of our current culture in America in 2017 can be highlighted, and we can better understand the strife and issues all around us. These are things that cause our society to fail to work. Senseless or without understanding. This is ignorance of God. We see this today. People don't seem to understand the commands of God, and they don't wish to try. There's a tremendous lack of biblical knowledge. And without such understanding, there's no yardstick. If you take away my Bible, if you take away my yardstick, how am I going to measure any behavior? What's good to this person is not good to that person. So what is good and what is evil? And people fail to understand that following the commands of God will result in a good life, can result in a joyful life. Rather, we find people want to write their own rules, and then they're angry and resentful if the yardstick of the Bible is put up against their behavior. You hear him say, "How dare you judge me?" Disobedient to the will of God. Ignorance leads to disobedience as people that don't understand the will of God. They do not act in appropriate ways. And Paul speaks elsewhere of times of ignorance. Acts 17:30, when he's talking to people, saying the times of ignorance, but now you should listen and understand. 1 Timothy 1:13, false teachers might be in mind here as they were disobedient. Deceived or deluded from the correct path in life. This is especially true of so-called Christian teachers who deceive others and deceive themselves concerning doctrine. And it's also true of those who live in sin without any knowledge of God. Jesus compared the way of the righteous and wicked to roads, and he said, the path to destruction is broad, but the road to life is narrow, and few there be who find it. Slaving for desires and pleasures. Now, Jesus told those that followed him that if they continued in his word, they'd be free. And he went on to say that those who commit sin are the slave of sin. But his audience denied that they were slaves. No, they said, we're not slaves. We're children of Abraham. We're the good guys. We're not slaves. And so they refused to see or acknowledge their slavery. And the verse speaks to being a slave to desires and pleasures. Now, I'm not telling you to put a scowl on your face and never be happy about anything in your life. The Christian is normally happy. The Christian is joyful. The Christian has been given many promises. And so, there's nothing wrong with taking joy in many things, ordinary things of life. But to become a slave to those things is a whole different issue. And Paul here is talking about slaving. So you might be wondering, how do I know the difference between something that's allowed or something where I'm crossing the line? Well, as a Christian, I ask you to consider the question. What do you love with all your heart, soul, and mind? What do you love the most? Is it God, or is it something quite different? Because that which you love the most is the thing you worship. In America, we're the land of the free. Lincoln freed the slaves. And we are surrounded by slaves on all sides. You don't have to look far to see them. Some will be driven to work 80 hours a week. They neglect everything else. They're slaving for their job. They're slaving for their career. They're slaving to advance, do better, make money. Family, friends, worship goes by the wayside. It's a single-minded goal. It's my career. The job is all in all. Others may be led to not work at all in the pursuit of indolence. Life will pass them by as they sit in their chair. Work or needful products, projects that need to get finished, they're always in the planning stage. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. But execution never comes. Everything is put off. Now, some people spend their money faster than they earn it, and they become a slave to debt. They've never learned the secret of being content with what they have. So that little plastic credit card and the bill that comes every month, that's the master they serve. And let me tell you something, it can be a harsh taskmaster, debt. The ringing of the phone inspires dread, can be a bill collector. Is this overdue? How can I get a cash advance from this card so I can pay the minimum on that card? If the overtime gets cut, I'm going to have to sell my boat. Others hang on to every dime. And they come to depend on and worship the money that's saved up in the bank. Money's not a means to an end anymore. It's an end in itself. This is what they love. And they don't want to spend any of it. They want to add to it. The pile has got to increase all the time. And they never realize the parable of the farmer that had all kinds of goods, and the Lord said, "You're a fool. Your soul's going to be demanded of you tonight. Then who's going to get all this stuff?" You know, I've always been myself personally very careful with money. My father, even more so. But Mom got so she couldn't walk, and we had to put her in a nursing home, and I wrote that check every month. The check for 1 month of care in the nursing home would have taken them on a vacation of a lifetime with money left over. But they saved the money up. Money's a means to an end. If you need to spend some, spend it. There isn't any pockets and coffins for that money to be tucked away with you. Nobody wants to consider themselves a slave. Everyone likes to say, "I'm free. It's a free country." Yeah. Technology is great when it works. How free are we? Never in the history of the country have so many people been overweight. It's a plague. In 1820, the average person consumed 20 pounds of sugar per year. In 2012, 130 pounds of sugar a year. We have a plague of young people dying of opioid overdose. In search of that higher high, they take too much and they die. Young. Whole life in front of them. Grieving parents are gone. Right down the road, we got the Seneca Nation where tobacco products can be purchased tax-free. New York City, pack cigarettes, $13. Seneca Nation, carton of cigarettes, $22. So some love to eat and drink. Others will virtually starve themselves to death in their obsession to be thin. Some constantly think about exercise, supplements, diet, whatever they're going to do. And others abuse their body with tobacco, drugs, or alcohol. People can be slaves to many things. What do you think about when you get up in the morning? What do you think about before you go to bed at night? What are you obsessing about? You don't want to be a slave to these things. It's time to be free. Living in malice and envy. These are relationship poisons. The poisons work in people and they find an outlet, usually in very unpleasant ways. Malice means to turn toward that which is wicked. Some people like to stir up trouble just for the fun of the turmoil and the problems. Particularly true of troubles for others. Others like to gossip and hear about trouble and talk about it. "Oh, did you hear about so-and-so?" Envy can be the desire to have or be something belonging to somebody else. Or simply the wish that someone else did not have that quality, position, or possession. It can be malice fueled by envy. So whether we look at malice or envy, nothing but evil ever comes of these. At one time in my career, I was on the management side. At one time in my career, I was the president of the union. And I dealt with envy. And my definition of envy is, this fellow over here would rather have 50 cents and me have nothing than both of us have a dollar. That's envy, and I saw it. I saw it, like when something perhaps was offered at the bargaining table for a distinct group over here, and the guys on the committee that weren't in that group said, well, why should they get that? And as a president, I said, if there's something on the table, we scoop it up. You never leave anything on the table. Whatever there is for your membership, you get it. Today is their day. Tomorrow might be yours. But we had to deal with envy. Who can stand before envy? It's hard. I'm fighting with technology and failing here. I think the pastor might have bigger ears than I do. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Detestable, which can be translated as hateful. The person who lives in malice and envy is generally hated by others. This can be a type of person that you find no merit in them, nothing lovely to enjoy. You avoid them, hating one another. Well, when you mix detestable people together, the natural outcome is they hate one another. There's no God-given qualities to help in the mix. I mean, if you see some of these demonstrations on the television where you get one group screaming over here and you get another group screaming over here, pretty soon they're pounding on each other. That's the sort of thing you can end up with. You know, my advice is, if something like that's going on, by all means, don't go there. Leave it alone. Stay away from it. Now, when he said, we were once like this, Paul's reminding the church, we're not like this anymore. We've gone away from that. Each and every saved person has undergone a change. Being born again by the Spirit and water. And this is a continuing change as we learn and as we grow. The Christian doesn't stand still in their Christian life, nor should they. Now, if you ask me, am I different from what I was when I was first saved? Of course, when I was a very young man, I knew everything then. Unfortunately, as I've got older, I've changed, and now I realize I don't know everything. And I'm constantly attempting to learn something new, learn something more. But if you talk to any sincere Christian, they'll tell you, well, you know, I came along and I learned about this, and I came along and I realized that, and I changed this, and I like to do this ministry. I found I'm equipped for it. I can do it. And the Christian life is a life of constant change. Standing up for Jesus includes leaving things behind. They're remnants of a past. Things that we find we don't need anymore. Things that we find we don't desire anymore. But these are replaced by other things. And so there's different things that we wish to do now and that we enjoy. And we find joy in many places. So leaving some things behind is an outward manifestation of an inward change. So if someone says they're saved, but you see absolutely no change in their life, then you wonder if the grace is working in them to bring about some kind of change. None of us stay the same. And change is positive, but change can be hard too. It can be hard to give up new things, can be hard to learn something else, or perhaps a friend from before, or perhaps a habit from before. It's not super easy, but it is necessary. So these things are an explanation of why we do the things we do. People who are not Christians are going to look and they're going to say, why is this person like this? Christianity, at its core, is not logical. Most people are driven by self-interest. What's good for me? So if you are a person who is zealous for good works and wants to do something good for other people, just to do it, that's not logical. And it's not common. And so somebody is bound to wonder, why are you doing the things that you're doing? But first, before all of that, you should look down at verse 2 where it says, to malign no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration for all men. See, we can be doctrinally correct, but not pleasant. We can be on the money as far as the scriptures, but perhaps not peaceable or not conciliatory. And the way that you say something, or even the way that you do something, is speaking volumes about who you are and what you think about the other person. So, number one, as Christians, we need to understand the motivation of the unsaved. What's going on? What's going on in their hearts and in their minds? Well, the verse is telling us. We were once foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. There it is. Why do they do the things they do? This is why they do the things they do. But the gift of God, of salvation through Christ, is out there waiting for them. We can talk to them about it, we can tell them about it, but they're either going to accept what they say, or they're not going to listen. Some don't listen, some won't listen. But these motives that explain why they do what they do are not to apply to us. They're not to explain. They are not ever to explain why we do the things we do. Oh, I've got to get my own way, so I'm going to do this or that unpleasant thing. No. No. Well, I wish I had whatever it is that this one's got over here, and so I'm going to do whatever it takes to get it, or I'm going to try to deprive them of it. No. So such things, when Paul says we were once like this, he's also saying these things are not to come into the church. This is never, ever to be the explanation of why some member of the congregation or some faction of the congregation is acting the way they act. We were once like this. We're not like this now. Now, when the people of God happen to find themselves doing these things, then the answer is they must repent. Turn again. Make that U-turn because you passed the exit. and go back the way you came. Now, next time, we are going to talk about the kindness of God and the love of God appearing and becoming visible right before our eyes. And that's a passage I'm really going to enjoy talking about. But we also have to remember, along with the joy in the things we are doing, we also need to remember some of the things we must not do. But we'll have our closing song now.